Okay, first of all, I want to thank Susan for inviting me to be the keynote speaker here, and this is quite a daunting challenge, actually. So I'm recording what I'm saying now, because even if you don't trust me, you could at least hold me accountable. And I think, in a sense, that's part of the punchline of what I want to tell you, because I think, to a large degree, trust is a somewhat misguided notion, but that doesn't mean that people shouldn't be held accountable. So if you want to find out more about me, there I am. I'm a historian, philosopher, and sociologist by training. And I think the first thing to say from a philosophical standpoint is that there are certain words, such as trust, but also the word reliability, that mean two things at once, okay? In a sense, they're making reference to a way you should delegate authority to those who know more than you, but also there's an issue about those other people who you delegate authority to ought to be held responsible for whatever happens. So in that respect, you're really offloading your mind to the people you trust, right? So if they get it wrong, it's their fault. Okay, I really want to put that on the table here, because one of the things that I think is very important, insofar as we think of ourselves as living in an increasingly democratic society where people are increasingly educated, and including being educated in science, and not only in the strict scholastic sense of taking science courses, but also being exposed to science through the media, and also having access to scientific information through the internet, that there's a point at which people feel it upon, you know, take it upon themselves actually to think that on the one hand, as was pointed out in the previous talk, right, on the one hand, that people actually do trust science, and they trust scientists, and you have no problem with it. But on the other hand, they want to take their own judgments with regard to what they make of scientific information in various contexts. And I think this is kind of the issue that we're moving toward here, okay? In other words, I don't think this is an issue where, to a large extent, the professional scientific community can actually control the game. Okay? So in other words, there's a sense in which you shouldn't be thinking about this problem as a matter of recovering lost trust. Right? If what you're talking about is, you know, that they should just let the scientists do things for themselves. I think the issue is more a matter of whether you know, those of you, part of the scientific community, whether you're willing to trust ordinary people to make judgments that they claim to be based on some kind of science. I think that's more the issue, right? And as we move toward a more sort of democratic society where people are exposed to science increasingly, they are taking more science courses even if they're not professional scientists, and as I think is true of all the public understanding of science surveys, they are very pro-science. I think all these things are true. But what this means is that the scientists have to trust people to make their own judgments about the science. And I think this is the tricky part. Okay? So insofar as there is an issue of trust with regard to science, it has to do, I think, less with whether the public trusts the scientists than whether the scientists are willing to let go of a certain amount of authority with regard to judgment to the ordinary people. Now, Brexit was mentioned in the previous talk, okay? This was a pretty, for those of you who do not live in the UK, this was a very radical thing for the UK, because the UK actually has a very limited history of referendum. Okay? For the most part, Britain is a kind of elitist democracy. It's a parliamentary democracy, which means that all the decisions are discussed amongst all of these very well-qualified, still for the most part, people who went to Oxbridge, right? And that's pretty much how democracy is done in the UK. And the only time where the people actually participate is when they vote for one of these Oxbridge people. I vulgarize slightly, but the point is, in comparison to the United States, there's a real difference here. And that's why, in a sense, the Brexit thing seems so striking in the UK. Because here was a really important decision with regard to whether to stay or remain in the European Union that was opened up for the public to decide for themselves. And regardless of what one thinks about the campaign, to my mind, it wasn't really much different in terms of the amount of truths and falsehoods that you normally find in a political campaign, except for the fact that the stakes were higher. Okay? The stakes were higher. That was the only thing that mattered. But in terms of the level of truth and falsehood, it was pretty much the same. And under normal circumstances, people would be trusted to make decisions for themselves and so forth. And of course, it helps in a parliamentary democracy that the people who you in fact elect are only there for a limited amount of time, and you can get rid of them. Whereas with regard to Brexit, we don't know when this is going to end. Okay, so there are some important differences there, but they're not really differences about the competence of the people making the decision. Because in fact, we tolerate this under normal democratic circumstances. It's just that with the case of Brexit, there wasn't the sort of structures of accountability, right, which would lead people in the future to say, okay, maybe we need to change our minds. Right? So once this Brexit decision is made, it's not clear how you could reverse it. Right? And I think that's the issue here. But generally speaking, if we're talking about, you know, living in a democracy and increasing greater degree of democratic judgment, then we should assume over time that people are in fact able to inform themselves by whatever means that's necessary, and to be able to take judgments that they think is in their interest based on this knowledge. And so then the interesting question becomes, it seems to me, is the possibility for getting people to change their minds, to reverse decisions. Okay, and this is where I think democracy, you know, in terms of where does democracy turn out to be a kind of mechanism for learning, it has to do with reversibility. Okay, so this is a term. Those of you who know something about Karl Popper, the great philosopher of science, this is really what we're talking about, right? Namely, once you make a judgment one way or another, can you reverse it once you see the consequences? Okay? And it seems to me this is the thing that we should always be pushing for. In other words, we should not be saying that people are stupid. We should not be saying that people are unable to make decisions on even rather complex matters that have a very strong scientific component to them. But rather what we should do is that we should provide a kind of environment in which it's possible for people to change their mind safely, okay, once they have made a decision. And I think that you know, not only in the chemistry community, but for the scientific community more generally, I think this is kind of the attitude that one should be working toward, right? So I think there's a sense in which, you know, insofar as we have encouraged people to study science, and insofar as science has in fact become increasingly part of the mass media, and it's part of the way in which policymakers think about the world, there's no turning back the clock to think that we have to somehow get to some period where people trust scientists in some absolute sense. I think that's gone. So don't even bother thinking about that. What we're talking about is a ceding of authority, and then, you know, in a way, hoping that we can set up environments in which people can decide that what they've done is right or wrong. Okay? So I think this is kind of the issue that we should be going toward. Now, one of the things that, if you read the abstract of my talk, one of the things that I pointed to as a kind of precedent was the idea of science connoisseurship. Okay? And this is not, you know, science connoisseurship. We don't normally think about these two words together, but I think they're very important, actually, in terms of what we're actually trying to encourage in the general public with regard to science. And this is something other than just blind trust. So think about art connoisseurship, right? Art connoisseurship does not involve the connoisseur, the person who's typically in a position of purchasing art, you might say, to actually trust what the artists say about their work. Right? They make an independent judgment. But it's clearly a judgment based on their... So these are people, the connoisseurs, who may not actually be able to do any art themselves, right? But they know enough about the history of art, they know enough about the context in which art is produced, that they are able to make independent judgments. Of course, informed by what artists say, but not dependent on it so exclusively, with regard to what is worth, you know, purchasing or not purchasing, at what price, etc., etc. Okay? Now, this idea that there could be something called science connoisseurship was put forward in the period immediately after World War II by the first science-based person to be a president of an Ivy League university, James Bryant Conant, who some of you may know, who was a chemist. Okay? And Conant was very much involved as part of the administration of the atomic bomb project, and some of you may know he was the one who actually was part of the, who helped to convince Harry Truman actually to drop the bomb on Hiroshima. And Conant was a very important guy in a lot of different ways with regard to the development of higher education in the United States in the second half of the 20th century. But one of the things that he was very keen on was that there be kind of general education in science for people who were not going to pursue science. Okay? Why? Well, again, thinking of Harvard. Harvard is, basically educating the people who will be running the country, and whether we're talking about politics or business or whatever, and those people will need to know about science, certainly after the atomic bomb, that's for sure. And so the question is, how can these people make a kind of measured judgment that goes beyond the hype at both levels, right? Because there's two kind of hypes that one wants to avoid. One wants to avoid, of course, the scaremongering, right? Because with Hiroshima and so forth, right? You can imagine this will kill nuclear power, blah, 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 and it almost did, right? But on the other hand, you want to also kill the hype that comes from scientists trying to get funding. Right? So in other words, you want to kill it at both levels. You want people to be able to develop a kind of independent judgment, right, about the nature of, and Conant was of the view, and again, this is something that might be worth thinking about and discussing, actually. Conant was of the view that no science before its time, right? So in other words, the first thing to do when you want to assess whether or not some new scientific project ought to be supported is whether, is the basic science there already? To what extent will you have to, you know, sort of develop more science before you can actually apply the stuff? So that would be that's a very key component as far as Conant was concerned. And that's one of the reasons why Conant thought that people ought to learn about the history of science, and in particular the history about how particular disciplines have developed and where they were in their trajectory, so they could make clear, independent judgments about what's hype and what's likely. Okay? And those are very important things. And you know, for those of you who know something about the Cold War era, many of you seem to be old enough to know about this, that in fact, the Cold War era, to a large extent, was the golden age of science policy. But there is a question that was on the table, and I think Conant realized this as well, even though he didn't really speak out against it, was the extent to which the promotion of science was based on hype or whether it was based on something that could actually be done. And the point is, you want people who are not scientists to be able to develop an independent standpoint from which to make such a judgment. Okay? And so for this reason, Conant was very supportive of the history and philosophy of science as a field by which people who are not going to major in science could actually understand how science works. Now, the person who was his protege and actually did a lot of the understudy teaching while Conant was first ambassador to West Germany from the United States was this guy called Thomas Kuhn. Some of you may have heard of this guy. I hope so. Thomas Kuhn is probably the most influential historian and philosopher of science of the second half of the 20th century, okay? And the thing about him was that he was a physicist, but realized early on that the most important thing that he could do with regard to the way science was operating was not necessarily to contribute to physics, but rather to contribute to this kind of public understanding which President Conant was beginning to scope out. Okay? And so his famous book from 1962, Kuhn's famous book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, is in fact based on these undergraduate general education in science courses that Kuhn was the understudy for with Conant. Okay? And what was this course like? Well, it was basically they focused on case studies from the history and philosophy of science, and they were basically about figuring out how scientists decided that certain theories were true or false. In a way, pretty straightforward kind of assignment, you might say, but for people who were not familiar with the day-to-day working of science, this was quite illuminating to actually see how scientists come up with these kinds of judgments. Okay, and so this was what the course was about. And on this basis, then, Conant and Kuhn came up with this kind of general view about how science develops. Now, the interesting thing about this view about science, which is talked about in terms of paradigms and revolutions, some of you may be familiar with Kuhn from this kind of language, was that it was science, as it were, determining its own course. So in other words, there's an enormous amount of trust being placed on the scientific community to determine when something has been successfully shown, when we need to move on, etc. Okay? Now I think this part of the story, which Conant thought was the thing that really people needed to understand, he thought that would solve the problem, as it were, of people's trust in science. Right? So in other words, if the young people, you know, who are coming into the atomic age actually understood how the history of science collectively makes its judgments about what is true and false, that then they will be able to say, okay, the science has reached its state of maturation, and so now it can be applied in this way, whereas the science in this other case perhaps has not reached the appropriate stage of maturation, and so it's got to, you know, we have to just let the scientists work on this before we start applying anything. Okay, this is the kind of judgments that he was assuming that students would be able to make as a result of these kinds of courses. Now, I think one of the things that we have seen in the past, let's say, in the course of my lifetime, okay, so I enter into this story maybe in the early 1980s, is that this kind of neat story about science self-determining itself, right? This idea that no science before its time. This has been shattered, right? This fundamental assumption has been shattered, right? So if we want to reinvent some kind of notion of science connoisseurship of the sort that Conant and Kuhn were behind, and I'm supportive of this. This is my point, right? I'm talking about this to you because I support this. It's got to be done on different terms. It can't be done on the idea that in some sense people should just figure out, you know, when science has reached its state of maturity before which it could be applied, etc. Because there's a sense in which science, as certainly the way we do it today, is operating on many fronts at once in much more highly interdisciplinary settings, right, where the scientist, and I think this should be really resonant with people who are operating in chemistry, is not necessarily being dictated by discipline-based agendas, right? Because, you know, the thing about, even though Conant was a chemist, he and Kuhn, who was trained as a physicist, thought about the history of science as being led by physics, understood as a field that until the very recent past had largely dictated its own research agenda. Right? So these are scientists saying when the science is good, when it's bad, and having kind of control over then whether it can be applied or not. But in the case of a science like chemistry, and my point to you is that all of science is now like chemistry has been for the last 250 years. Namely, there have always been different actors impressing themselves on the agenda and moving it in various ways. Right? So there is no clear sense in any absolute disciplinary-based way about when a science has been mature. Okay? It's not there. And so this means we're talking about a much more sophisticated notion of connoisseurship, which involves not just knowing how the science has developed on its own terms, but also understanding something about how science relates to the state, how science relates to business, and how these things influence agendas for both better and ill, right? Or at least bias it in various ways. And this then becomes part of the education that ordinary people need to have with regard to science connoisseurship. It's a much more kind of sociologically informed idea of general science education. And let's say we implement something like that. Let's say that those of you listening to me are sympathetic to this general way of approaching. Then the following question arises. Namely, okay, once people have been educated in a way that they understand in a very clear way, not only the intellectual trajectory that a science has gone through, but they also understand the various, you know, financial, political kind of influences that are guiding the direction of science, again, for both for good and for ill. It goes both ways, but nevertheless, they appreciate that there are all these different vectors happening. And then the question becomes, okay, well, you now put them in a position of having to make a decision. What is it, how should they think about this decision? The non-scientists who nevertheless, are making decisions about how science proceeds in a society where science is increasingly important. How should they think about this? And here, I bring up a question that I think is very familiar to chemists, but interestingly, was completely absent from the initial discussion that Conant and Kuhn were part of. And this is the idea of risk. Okay? And see, it seems to me that risk assessment, the ability of people to assess risk, so it's one thing to say, okay, people understand what actually is the case in the world, they understand the chemistry well enough, they understand what is going on in the larger environment in which these various scientific things are happening. But then there's a question of how do you educate people to actually make a decision, a risk-based decision? Because that's really what we're talking about, right? At the end of the day, we're talking about risk. And frankly, I don't think the scientific community should be in the position of doing other people's risk analysis. The people should do it. And this is where, you see, this is the thing, that this is the kind of component that I think really does need to be stressed, that at the end of the day, all decisions based on science, especially complex ones, especially ones that involve innovations that haven't been totally proven in all possible environments, there's always going to be a certain measure of risk. And the question is, to what extent do we trust the people to make these risk-based assessments? Okay? And I think this has got to be very much part of general education in science, is how to evaluate risk assessment and how to come up with standards for people to make judgments on. What's comparable to what with regard to risk? Right? I mean, people make intuitive judgments about what's risky, but often these are very much made in isolation. It's not in comparison to other things. And so I do think that there's a certain sense in which we have to put that as part of the mix as well, as far as general education in science is concerned, is for people to become educated about what it means to take risks. And then to say, look, you're the people taking the risks. And then the question becomes, what happens if the risks that you've taken turn out not to be so good? How do we then correct the matter? How do we then reverse the decision? And see, this goes back to my initial point about reversibility. Because at the end of the day, I have you know as well as I do that there's no reason to think that ordinary people are any smarter than scientists or vice versa with regard to these kinds of decisions. But the question is going to be whether we have mechanisms in place to enable the reversibility of bad decisions, and indeed, even before we get to this point, whether there's sufficient transparency in following through the consequences of decisions that people can publicly recognize these decisions were wrong. Right? You need this to be in play. And it seems to me that this is a combination of not only education, but also the way the political system is organized. But at the end of the day, I think that there is really no way of getting around the fact that decision making concerning science and technology, even in some very deep ways, is going to be increasingly democratic. That, I think, is going to happen. The question is whether we have schooled the people properly to be able to assume this responsibility, and whether we have the mechanisms in place that encourage people to recognize when what they've done is in fact wrong. And I'll stop here because I think that this is kind of where I think we should be taking the issue and to move it away from trust as some kind of focal notion. Thank you.